Hello and welcome back to Even More News, the first and only news podcast. My name is Katie Stoll.
It still is.
Hi.
I also have a name, and it's Cody Johnston. Hi.
That's right. Cody Johnston, the one and only. I think there's probably several.
There are others. Yeah, there's a country music singer. I believe it's either Cody Johnston or Cody Johnston.
And you get a lot of crossover with that Johnson Johnston. Really easy to mix those two up.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Joining us today for the first time is Natalie Scherr, columnist at The New Republic, who writes about health, history, and politics. Natalie, hello.
Hey there. Thanks so much for having me.
We are thrilled to have you. Before we started recording, I told you this, but I'm going to say it again for everyone. We're big fans of your work and are really grateful to have you here today. This is going to be great.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're new here, so you might not know this, but we start every show, unfortunately. By wishing you whatever happy holiday it is. And today, September 17th, the day of this release, is Global Beer Responsible Day. Guys, throughout the world, you just... Wait, what is this holiday?
Wait, it's called Beer Be Responsible.
Beer, I said it and I didn't even get it. It's
they
bad.
Should
That's
send
a bad
that back.
One.
They should send that back and workshop it a little bit. It's confusing when you hear
you
it.
You could just be straightforward and say, like, don't drink and drive day, right?
That's the
goal here.
Drink responsibly is the phrase,
day.
Right? That everybody knows.
Yeah. I feel like globally we know what that means. Anyway, we have notes. It is also International Country Music Day. Cool.
So congratulations to other Cody Johnston on your
That's
amazing
correct.
Career in the country music scene.
That's like a top level callback, Cody.
Speaking of holidays, any day. And speaking of any day, using the internet. Yes, thanks to ExpressVPN for supporting our show. You probably don't think much about internet privacy on your own home network, but using the internet without ExpressVPN is a bit like driving without car insurance. Don't do that. Visit expressvpn.com/morenews to get an extra 3 months free on a 1-year package.
Okay, Natalie. Intros are done. How's it going? You're new here. Tell us a little bit about yourself. What's up? How you feeling in this stage, the pandemic? Anything, everything is fair game.
Yeah, I'm good. You know, decent summer. Looking forward to a New England fall. It's one of the things that we can say that the region has going for it is really gorgeous leaves for a total of a few days in October. So we're coming up on that. Going to pick some apples. Going to do some pumpkin spice. Make some soup in the slow cooker.
Incredible as we are still smack in the middle of fire season out here in California.
Yeah, well, you guys don't get much of a, you know, pumpkin spicy
anything.
Apple
Not
season either. So.
At all.
No.
I got
we'd
an
get it in our lattes.
Candle the other day just to fake it as much as I could. I actually have a question. So I'm from Ohio, mostly. I lived in Maine for a little bit too. Is the fall, is it less and less now every year? Is it like fewer days of the beautiful fall sweater weather type of thing that we have in our minds?
So that's a good question. I don't know the specifics. I have heard that climate change is affecting what they call leaf peeping season specifically.
Oh, no.
Leaf peeping being the horrible phrase that people use to describe, tourism and activities related specifically to checking out.
Okay, I thought it was like describing what the leaves were doing.
I kind of thought it was somebody peeping through leaves.
Okay.
You're peeping at the leaves. Yeah.
You're not using the leaves as cover for your peeping.
I mean, I guess that you could.
That is the first thing that I thought. Was like people behind bushes peeping through the
yeah,
beautiful
or like peeping
fall leaves.
Yeah, it's like this old-fashioned phrase. I guess it's probably some like old British thing, which is why I'd never heard it until I actually moved here 2 years ago. And so it's a big thing here. New England Magazine and the Boston Globe have interactive maps where you can click on a given part of New England and look at a calendar and see exactly how far in the progression the leaves will be so that you can plan your trips around, you know, when are they going to be like bright red?
Plan your peeps.
Cody, this might be interesting to you if you're specifically If you're specifically seeking to peep some fall leaves, you should check that out.
Now that I know that it has a name and that it's that name, I might lose interest in it, though.
Sure.
Like, yeah. I might just not want to anymore, but...
That's understandable.
But I am quite jealous of that cozy-sounding fall atmosphere. And, yeah, it sounds comforting. I think stuff like that sounds comforting during the pandemic. And I don't have it here. My girlfriends and I were thinking of going to pick apples this year. We're going to go, but we have to seek out something like that. It's like you have to play pretend that it's fall.
Right.
Also, they're selling pumpkins now, and I almost bought one, and I thought, it's way too hot. This is going to be rotten out there in like 5 days. I feel like we've been procrastinating and avoiding talking about the news for several minutes now. Maybe it's time. Maybe it's time we dive in and do it.
I guess
we have promised a pretty tall order, which is news.
I have news if you're interested.
Is it good news? Yeah. Is it like
nothing like that.
Broken news.
Yeah, I guess you could say eventually we'll get to some good stuff. Now I'm just thinking about if I can fit a pumpkin in my freezer. Get a pumpkin, ooh, shove it in there, wait a month. People are going to be jealous. All their pumpkins are going to be rotted and mine's going to be fresh and glistening.
I feel like in a month they can just buy a new pumpkin.
That's the other point. Although, Natalie, I got to say, last year had the same thought. Bought a pumpkin, learned from experience, nasty by the time it came, actual Halloween came around, tried to carve it, not good, went to the market, no more pumpkins. I got a squash.
The logic of you could buy a new pumpkin is messing with my plan.
I guess it depends on what day.
All right, broken news.
Broken news. So yesterday, Wednesday, current and former U.S. gymnasts, including Simone Biles, Ali Riesman, and Michaela Maroney, testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee, not just about the sexual assault that they endured at the hands of former Dr. Larry Nassar, but about the FBI's failure to take their reports seriously. Biles said that the FBI turned a blind eye to sexual crimes committed against hundreds of athletes, and retired gymnast Michaela Maroney said federal investigators minimized and degraded her after she reported her abuse. They believe up to 70 athletes continued to be abused after the FBI was first made aware of Nassar's behavior. He abused more than 330 women at USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University until he was finally fired and then arrested. He's serving life in prison. You know, Ali Riesman said the FBI didn't contact her until 14 months after she first reported the abuse to USA Gymnastics. And this has previously been framed as a real blight on USA Gymnastics, but yesterday made clear how much the FBI screwed this one up as well.
It's so upsetting. I felt a lot of rage looking at this news breaking, especially on the tails of everybody just going to town criticizing Simone Biles and her decision to withdraw from the competitions at the Olympics this year. And again, underscoring what she went through for this team, what many of her teammates went through and our expectations of them. And hearing this, the FBI. Yeah. So Christopher Wray is saying that he fired the agent that was in charge of this case. That's cool.
So we got him.
The one guy. What about his supervisor? How about the other cases that we have no idea that they covered up for whatever reason? Other investigations. Yeah, it's upsetting. Hot take. I'm upset.
Yeah, they say Christopher Wray, the FBI director, he apologized. He said the agency definitely screwed up. He said they fired one agent.
Oh, whoopsie.
Yeah, it was a whoopsie doodle. They fired one agent who was involved in the case early on, and there was another agent who has since retired who made false statements to the Justice Department. There was a cover up of this, a systematic cover up, because they realized they screwed up and they didn't want to be found out.
Okay, so we just wait till everybody retires.
The FBI is always the good guys, don't you know? So we just have to what? I don't know. I wasn't reading about any reforms that are being put into place. I'm not sure.
Certainly haven't seen that discussed. either. I mean, someone correct us if you have, but this is what it is. I don't know what will happen from this.
I have nothing to add except that it's a real fucking bummer.
I wish I had something, a good takeaway right now, but I don't.
I mean, something I took away from it is you can see how emotionally raw these athletes still are.
Yeah.
And I think there is a sense, or at least the media had a sense, that after Larry Nassar was arrested and put away, it's like, okay, you can move on and either go about your life or back to your gymnasticking, you know? And this is like still very upsetting that they weren't believed.
Right.
This was that they were dismissed and made humiliated about it. And I think
absolutely.
That's what's like so raw and enraging about.
Yeah. This. And I think for me, and I completely agree with you. You're correct. That is palpable and impossible to ignore. I think that I, going into this in all of these stories, I know that. I think that a lot of people don't take that into consideration, the long-term damage and impact of what this abuse, any kind of abuse, can have on people emotionally, physically. And I think that I feel tired of the same conversation of people being surprised. Not that I mean that in any way to shame you. I think that it's important for men to be paying attention and seeing that. But it's really hard time and time again to be like, yes, believe people. Yes. Understand that we carry this trauma in our bodies, or everybody, you know, you carry it, and it will take a lifetime. Probably. I mean, you don't necessarily ever recover from it.
And this is the kind of thing where like it's high profile people. And this kind of thing happens every day. Like obviously like local police and like it's a microcosm of like a much larger thing that happens all the time that we never hear about and probably will never hear about in many cases.
But it's very traumatic. And I think that there's a lot of people also that can't look at it so closely because it's triggering for them, you know?
Did Jim Jordan have anything to say about it?
Ooh. You know what?
No,
don't
I
care.
I intentionally didn't look to see if Jim Jordan.
There's zero part of me that cares what Jim Jordan has to say on it. All right, let's go on to another piece of news, shall we? Keep this broken train going.
Yeah, do you all know that there was a recall this week in California?
Oh, dang, I forgot.
You heard about that?
Obama kept telling me on my TV about it.
Yeah, the recall was Tuesday in California, with 71% of the vote counted as of this recording. No, which means don't recall Gavin Newsom, is up 64-36%. This was called by the news networks within about 30-40 minutes of the polls closing. That 26-point margin is probably going to narrow a bit as the in-person votes get counted, which are more Republican. But it was a big repudiation of what was a giant expensive waste of time.
Yeah. Speaking of expensive, I had originally tweeted about it, you know, earlier numbers looking at like $215 million, but now it's looking more like it was $276 million fucking dollars for this bullshit. Absolute bullshit. Clown show. California being the easiest state to call a recall election. And this was just a huge debacle, a expensive debacle that we can't afford. That money, to think of what could have been done with that money for our communities that desperately need it, for wildfire prevention, for our unhoused citizens. It's ghastly. And we've got an election again very soon. He's got like a year and a half or something like that left in office. And he's about to start campaigning for re-election. And, you know, Jonathan wrote this down in our notes. Like, I don't know how this affects his election in November 2022. He kept his place in office in this recall because it was bullshit and stupid. But no, he is not progressive. No, he is not beloved by a lot of members of this California community. And no, if I had the choice, I would choose a different governor. So yeah, it is frustrating to think that this was also campaigning for him ahead of time in the reelection. I'm curious how this affects our chances to get a more progressive challenger in the race. So it's all interesting and frustrating, and very glad that Larry Elder is not our governor.
Yeah,
but also those, all the, like, things I just said.
It's one of those Democratic Party hostage situation things, right? Where it's like, it's garbage or the garbage is on fire. And you're like, well, I don't want to burn the garbage, I guess. So I guess we'll keep the garbage around. There's always a situation like this, and it's very frustrating to always have to be like, no, Gavin Newsom's good, and we want him to stay the governor. Hard to get fired up, but it worked apparently. So,
well,
Natalie, did you follow this at all, or were you happily like, oh, I don't have to worry about this thing right?
Yeah,
now?
I'm curious how this tracks across the nation.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely followed it to some degree. I used to live in California. And I think that Katie's right on the money, that he's been a very frustrating governor, especially the way that he ran as a progressive. He ran as a fairly mm-hmm. ardent single payer supporter, and mm-hmm. he really hasn't governed in that way. And not only did he break initial campaign promises, but now he owes people so much more because of the stupid recall that, you know, yes. was definitely brought on by Republicans, but that in a way he, you know, I mean, with some of his COVID gaffes, I think he walked into it and lost some support that he would have had. And so it's, you know, doubly, triply frustrating.
Yeah.
I just hope that he repays these constituents that worked their ass off to get him elected or to keep him elected.
I doubt he will. You bring up a very good point. I hope I've said this at some point. All of our shows blend together into a fun blur. Gavin Newsom, pretty much every California governor, there's an attempt for them to be recalled. Republicans initiated this right after Newsom was elected, and it didn't really start to gain steam until COVID stuff. And even then, it wasn't going to happen. They got an extension, but after his gaffes, and specifically where he went out to the French Laundry for French Laundry being an obscenely expensive, ritzy place that you can't get reservations for. And he had a birthday party inside unmasked in the midst of this severe winter California lockdown.
I'm going to pull up the menu.
And yeah, that's not a good look.
Yeah, Republicans didn't force him to do that.
And that's really when it took. Yeah. And so then it happened.
Really easy to not.
They got enough signatures. His actions, the things that the people were not happy with him. And
no prices on the menu.
No prices on the menu.
That means
you
know.
It's cheap. That means they don't want to spoil.
That means
they're
open to negotiating is what that means.
It's also frustrating. Council people, Mike Bonin and Nithya Raman, have recall elections of their own. They are much better politically than Gavin Newsom, also facing these completely BS Republican-funded recall elections, largely over homelessness and housing policy, as far as I understand.
And our district attorney, Gascon, as well, they're trying to recall. I have to feel that those efforts have to feel a little bit deflated.
Yeah.
Now.
I don't know where they stand on where those efforts are right now, but yeah.
I don't know if they have enough signatures yet.
But it's very indicative. Like, yeah, that's also just the climate. That's the world we're living in of people saying, I'm challenging this, I'm challenging it. And so you end up spending a lot of your time fighting a challenge while you're...
Right. Well, and potentially, you know, it's the kind of thing that could potentially slip through more easily because you're not going to have, like... Like I said, like Bernie Sanders was on my TV telling me to vote no. Barack Obama was on my TV telling me to vote no. That probably did help a lot. And in these more...
Right, exactly.
You're not going to have that kind of power behind it.
But hopefully being in LA, being what it is, hopefully they don't get enough attraction. Let's do this next one, Boston. Well, bring it local to you.
It's not all about California. Boston had a mayoral primary this week. Boston's next mayor, and Natalie, you'll have to correct me if I'm messing up the pronunciation here, since you know more about it than I do. Boston's next mayor will be either Michelle Wu or Anissa Asaibi George, two city council members who won the most votes in the primary election Tuesday night. Whoever wins in November will become the first elected mayor of Boston to be a woman of color. Boston's acting mayor, Kim Janey, is a black woman, but she was not elected. She assumed the post after former mayor Marty Walsh left to become President Biden's Secretary of Labor.
That's pretty exciting sounding.
Yeah. How is there a good feeling.
How are these candidates? How do you feel about them outside of them being women?
Yeah, so it is pretty exciting. Michelle Wu is a pretty decent progressive. I think if she, so she was the top vote getter. It's not actually a primary, it's a preliminary election. Boston's municipal offices, for whatever reason, are nonpartisan. And so they have a preliminary election, and then for each office, the top two vote getters are going to square off in the general election. And for some of the at-large seats, it's a few more, you know, for city council anyway, each district has two people, and then there are a few at-large seats that compete among the whole city. And then, you know, I think as of Tuesday morning, there were 17 of those, and they've narrowed the field down to, I believe, 8. And it's going to be for 4 seats. So not technically a primary, although I think the vast majority of people, save for maybe one council person, are pretty, you know, they would be Democrats, or they are Democrats outside of this context. But Michelle Wu is pretty good. She's been an at-large councilor since 2014. She is has been the top vote getter in the city council, and she's pretty progressive. She ran on a Green New Deal, fare free transit. I would definitely put her more in the Elizabeth Warren position than the Bernie Sanders one. But if she does win the general election, and she was the top vote getter with maybe just under 1/3 of the vote earlier this week, so if she does hold that lead over Anissa Atsayebi-George, who is, you know, pretty run-of-the-mill moderate, I think. Mm-hmm. Definitely going to be a pretty straightforward progressive versus moderate election. Most observers, I think, are feeling pretty good about Michelle Wu's chances. And if she does win the general election, I think she'll be one of the more progressive mayors of any city of Boston size in the country. So, yeah, it's pretty good news.
I mean, of course, I think it's important also to like contextualize, like, yeah, I have hopes for this person. I think that they're pretty good. It's not necessarily perfect, but it's would be cool to see this step in the right direction. And I really wish that for you guys, for all of us.
I clicked through to boston.cbslocal.com to see if they put primary, and it wasn't my fault, but nope, they said preliminary election, and my
but
brain
that's
was
close
just
enough.
Like, these are
you
called
substitute
primaries.
It.
That's a very easy blip. I just thought I'd do a little Boston politics lesson.
And honestly, if you didn't, anybody that listens in Boston would have been upset with you, I would imagine. They would have.
Yeah, no, you're much better at correcting me than someone on Twitter would be, so I appreciate that.
Our fans are nice. They're not mean.
They're nice.
All right, let's do this one, huh?
Yeah,
this next one. I want to talk about AOC's Met Gala dress, but I want to talk about the Met Gala, but just briefly. But yeah, go ahead, Jonathan.
I mean, I don't have much else to say other than the Met Gala was days ago, and we're still talking about this dress and the response to it. There's a whole bunch of other stuff about why Nicki Minaj didn't go to the Met Gala, which I don't think we're going to get into today because we only do one episode a week, but AOC wore a white dress with Tax the Rich written on it in red lettering to the Met Gala. The theme of the gala was American independence. Everyone has a take on this dress. There have been so many op-eds and takes about someone said that her intention was unclear, which I don't think it was.
That can't have been a take of anybody so reasonable.
That was in the Washington Post, where they're like, it's unclear exactly what she meant by this. I mean, in 600 words, they wrote this. So.
Oh, they only needed one word.
Yeah, whatever on AOC in the dress. I'm tired of talking that and unpacking it. But yeah, as the conversation continues, and here we are continuing it, I feel frustrated. Just the tone deafness of it all, of the contrast of, you know, like, yes, there were Black Lives Matter protesters outside, but just in general, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people have died. They don't have money. People are unemployed. And we've got these celebrities, these artists, you know, that people look up to, and politicians, that we pin our hopes and we're hoping for change, and these people represent that, and they're showing up to this event that's just a fundraiser for the Met Gala, which I think they've got some good money. You know, the last I checked, I mean, I didn't ever check, but from what I understand, like, this could have been a fundraiser for something more, I don't want to say important, but there's life and death situations happening around the world that could be use a $30,000 yeah. ticket or whatever it is. You know,
I saw somebody refer to it as her local art gallery, which I thought was an interesting interpretation, presentation of that.
AOC's local art gallery?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like she's a congresswoman supporting her local art gallery, was the take there. Yeah, it's you know, I mean, as the fact that there are three Washington Post op-eds in 3 hours, the optics are maybe not great.
Well, it's also because people want to watch it. People want to click. They're making them because those articles, because people click through. And yeah. And there is this celebrity worship. There is our, you know, yeah. Anyway,
I mean, there's a commodification of like this sort of idea, and like it's like a brand sort of thing. It's fine to get the message out. I think I've mentioned this on the other show. Like, most people agree already. Like, taxing the rich isn't like a controversial thing. It's controversial to like conservative commentators and certain people and politicians, but like generally it polls very well. So like the idea of like, oh, she's getting the message out, to me is like, well, everyone already agrees with the message. It just seems like maybe bringing all classes together to have the conversation will still mean that the class that usually dictates how the conversation goes will still do that, even if, quote, the other ones are at the table. Is all I am saying.
You're referring to what she said when she was asked about it.
When she was asked about it, she did like a red carpet thing, and she was talking about like equity and fairness and stuff. And it's like, you know, it's time. It's time we bring all classes to the table. Maybe
she didn't need to make that point in that way on that day in that medium. But yeah, Natalie, you had something.
Yeah, I totally agree with that point. I think class power is a zero sum game, and so it's less about bringing the upper class to the table and cajoling them to, you know, give better answers, and more about building power from below and taking money, which will be inherently somewhat confrontational.
Right. Yeah. There's a sense of like trying to bring class consciousness by promoting class collaboration when like the conflict is what it's actually about and how things actually change. And that's
good, like Cody.
That video was worse than the dress, I think. I didn't mind the dress in particular. I did mind the way that she described it on the video after.
Yes.
I actually didn't watch that. And
it's
I'm
like
glad
20
I didn't.
Seconds, but yeah, she doesn't seem like she's like ready to go with something strong to say about it.
Mm-mm. Okay, with that, I think it's time for us to take a real quick little ad break, but then we're going to be back with even more news.
News. Hi. Using the internet without ExpressVPN is a bit like driving without car insurance, or riding a bike without bike insurance, or hiking without hiking insurance, or using the internet without a VPN. Every time you connect to an unencrypted network, cafes, hotels, airports, bars, airport bars, hiking insurance stores, hackers on the same network can gain access to your personal data, passwords, financial details, favorite leaf. With the right software, a 12-year-old could hack you and make, like, money from it. Headline, heartwarming, 12-year-old bought his entire class lunch by hacking some dupe. You are the dupe in that headline. Anyway, ExpressVPN acts as an online insurance by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet, so hackers can't steal your personal data. Like how hiking insurance creates a secure, encrypted... Okay, this bit isn't working. ExpressVPN is so secure and simple, even Mies can use it. It literally is the tap of a button from an app on any device. Phones, laptops, tablets, desktop laptops, mini handheld tablets, lap phones, and more maybe. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/morenews. That's expressvpn.com/morenews, and you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/morenews.
And we are back as promised with even more news.
News.
Perfectly done. Let's talk about the unvaccinated, shall we? Natalie, I know you have thoughts on how we are dealing with the unvaccinated.
You got to put a little more spice on it, though. Whenever you talk about them, you got the unvaccinated.
Let's talk about like really... the unvaccinated.
There we go.
Right now, about 64% of eligible people in the United States are fully vaccinated, and 75% has had at least one dose, which is better than prior to this time. That's slightly better. But still, the vast majority of people who remain unvaccinated say that they will not get shots, even in the face of employer mandates, which is what's starting to happen. Also, I just want to throw out that even though those statistics are better, we're still the least, if not the least, almost the least vaccinated major country. I almost called us a company, but we're not. But aren't we, though? So let's talk about the effectiveness of Biden's vaccine mandate and if it's going to be effective, and also how our system, how we should be treating those who choose to remain unvaccinated. Yeah, okay, let's just start with that. How effective do we think vaccine mandates are going to be? As of right now, they haven't done anything. You know, recent polls are showing pretty decent support for mandating vaccines, but it's kind of indicative of the same amount of people that are vaccinated and don't want to get vaccinated.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to give a little bit of context, this is the largest mass vaccination campaign in American history. It's truly unprecedented. And I bring that up because I think it's related directly to how to think about vaccine mandates. The mass vaccination that we have done is generally done with school mandates for children, you know, your MMRs, et cetera, and that we've pretty much just taken it for granted that that's how we do large vaccine mandates. Historically, there have been moments where, you know, smaller areas, maybe municipalities or neighborhoods, instituted vaccine mandates that truly applied to everybody. But the idea of, you know, how do we get an entire country of 300 million people, or, you know, 300 million minus however many are under 12 right now, how do we get that many people vaccinated is a huge question that we've never had to answer before. And then we had to start answering this question in 2020, when Trump is still president. State and local health departments started begging for vaccination money sometime, you know, early summer, when some of the clinical trials were starting to look good, and they were saying, okay, if we're doing vaccination, if we're doing a vaccination campaign, we're going to need funding. That money didn't actually come through until December. It passed in Congress in December and didn't actually make it to state and local health departments until, you know, January, early February in some cases. And so what that means is that all of these health departments, all of these states, all of these localities basically had to build systems not knowing whether or not they'd have money, build systems that were basically passive for that reason. So, you know, places were using just free Evite software, or not Evite, you know, free calendar software so that people could log in and make their own appointments, relying on volunteers, not doing a lot of marketing and comms, things like that. And then by the time the money did come through, they had already been doing it for weeks or months in some cases. And so all of that is to say, we have attempted to embark on an unprecedented mass vaccination campaign using pretty passive piecemeal methods. Mm-hmm. And I think that we still have never gotten good enough at making the vaccines truly ubiquitous so that we can, you know, let people get them impulsively. I think that there are a ton of people who are potentially open to vaccination, but they don't really care that much. And you pretty much have to like stick it in the arm for that person.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't done enough to do any of that. So all of that is to say, there are all these things we could have done. As for mandates, I think people take for granted, oh yeah, mandate, force people, sure. As if that's like a coherent, straightforward, specific thing. And, you know, so far we've done it through primary schooling and college. And I think a lot of people, you know, I mean, at least in politically salient contexts, would still support that, but that's not going to get all of your adults vaccinated. You know, to whatever degree Biden is able to do it, he's trying to go through OSHA right now. Which
is that,
you know,
legal?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I feel
like there might be some pushback on that angle.
I mean, you know, the question of like, is it legal is really just, will it stand up in court?
I'm
not enough of a legal expert to say. But I think, like, you know, I mean, the federal ability to, you know, regulate workplaces, I think that it's, you know, fairly straightforward. It's only for large employers. But the problem is, like, you know, how do you enforce that? Like, OSHA is notoriously threadbare. It could be so much better at, like, regulating worker safety, but it's not, because it's been so hammered over time.
If a company, you know, is requiring vaccinations or the testing if they refuse to get vaccinated, but that's a big cost for the company as well. You know, you can't expect the employee to be paying that bill, you know, or having that come out of your paycheck. So, I mean, that's a consideration.
Seems likely that that's what it'll, like, a lot of places will try, right?
Well, so that is what a lot of places are trying. They call that, like, a soft mandate. And so I think that that's also, in terms of, like, will it hold up in court? It makes it legally safer. You're not necessarily, you know, it's not vaccine or get fired. It's vaccine or test weekly, which, you know, I think for a lot of people will effectively pester them into getting the vaccine. You know,
yeah, you don't want that thing shoved up your nose every week.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely wouldn't. And yeah, there are some just like strident anti-vaxxers who will stop at nothing to avoid it. But I think that population has been largely overstated in popular parlance about this issue.
That does seem true, right? Like, the media just wants, they got to have something. They want to amp it up to 20. And so, like, they take a lot of very, like, very vocal people for sure, but sort of inflating them to this, like, huge group of people that isn't really there, it seems.
I think you can absolutely lay a ton of blame on right-wing media and right-wing elected officials who, you know, at worst have actively vocalized anti-vaccine sentiment and at best have quietly acquiesced to it and tolerated it. And so, you know, that does allow anti-vax sentiment to thrive. And I think it also contributes to people thinking, oh, I don't know, I'm on the fence, I'll wait, or I guess I don't care that much. But I think it's much better to point the blame at, you know, the people who are spreading this than all the individuals who are unvaccinated, which is millions and millions of people, and not every single one of them is an asshole.
Right.
Well, most of them aren't, and most of them live in different areas and, yes, are susceptible to this kind of propaganda, you know, and, you know, maybe they're surrounded by people who believe the same thing. But yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I always want to push for, as easy as it is to always villainize these people that you don't disagree with. And sometimes it's appropriate, but a lot of times there's so much more nuance to it. Go ahead, Cody.
Oh, I mean, yeah. It's like what you're saying. Like, there's so many people, like, people who are really driving this are people who have definitely been vaccinated. They, you know, many of them first in line, got the vaccination, and now have been just raking in the dough, talking about how, like, oh, you know, maybe we don't know. We, like, maybe you shouldn't. Like, this, putting all this sort of doubt out there, and they're the real ghouls.
Yeah.
And
that can't be true. Tucker and Hannity? No, that can't be true.
But even like the soft deniers, like you were referencing, like a Ted Cruz or whatever, who will be like, oh, I got the vaccination and you should too if you want to. Like they'll say the thing that they know they're supposed to say, but then sort of whisper this other stuff that sort of like sows doubt, and like saying things like, you know, I got it, but like do your own research and ask your doctor. It's like, who has a fucking doctor? What are you talking about?
Yeah, they're using it as a culture war wedge issue, mm-hmm. because it's very useful for them. And I couldn't resent it more. I mean, sticking to the fact that, you know, I mean, people like that are the reason that vaccination rates are so low. You know, there is still more that we can do, but certainly they've contributed toward plenty of it. And they definitely deserve a lot of resentment, far more so than, you know, individuals who watch their shows.
Right.
And I want to move on to a similar but slightly different topic. But going back to how we started talking about this and your very valid points about the organization and the rollout of the sites and signups. Again, just that stuff. And I know a lot of that is also because of Donald Trump and the crossover as well. But in general, we are very bad about the little details like that and making it way more complicated and frustrating than it needs to be to also contribute to that. But I want to pivot slightly and talk about healthcare for the unvaccinated, because there have been several pieces and commentaries lately of people pontificating that the unvaccinated who get COVID-19 should pay more for health insurance and shouldn't get ICU beds. And I find that to be so off mark.
I was just waiting to hear. I find it such a good idea. Absolutely. No,
I was looking for the right word, but it's just, I mean, it feels ghoulish too, of like how quickly you abandon what the whole thing that we should be learning from this experience is that we need universal healthcare, that we need a health system that protects us, and that pre-existing conditions should not preclude people from getting the care that they need. Anyway, Natalie, you have written about this, and I love this piece that you wrote. So I'm gonna let you speak on this more than me.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I've been really, really dismayed by the way that people talk about these things. You know, besides the fact that I think it's more useful to blame the right-wing media, right-wing elected officials for fomenting these sentiments, I think that, you know, the ideological underpinnings of universal healthcare are that I want healthcare to be available free at the point of use for everyone. People, at least me, who support Medicare for All, who emphasize the fact that healthcare needs to be free at the point of use, it's not just an insistence on purity and perfect legislation. It's the fact that anytime you have cost sharing, so anytime someone has to pay out of pocket, you know, a deductible, a copay, coinsurance, that's a barrier. That makes it difficult for particularly poor people to access care. We see that in data over and over again, that copays, deductibles make people skip necessary health care. They can get sick and die as a result. And the best way to fund health care should just be progressive taxation on the back end, so that, you know, you're not, you're, basically, if you have cost sharing of any kind, then you are allocating costs based on health and not based on ability to pay. So, you know, before the ACA protections for pre-existing conditions, that meant that someone who happens to be sick for whatever reason ends up financially suffering so much more, or being barred from care altogether. Women, you know, had to pay so much more and face similar penalties because non-elderly women use more healthcare than non-elderly men do. And so the fact that the ACA placed so many protections against this was really good and one of its enduring accomplishments, and something that we should be grateful that we achieved, even if we need to achieve still so much more. And so the idea that people were so cavalier about, okay, we should charge people different amounts for, like, based on vaccination status, or, you know, we should allocate care based on vaccination status. We should, you know, keep unvaccinated people out of the ICU so that someone else with a health emergency who is vaccinated gets it. I mean, I think that you're just bringing this, you know, moral judgment about health status and what people deserve back into the healthcare conversation. And we have worked so hard to get it out, and it doesn't belong anywhere near it. Yeah. And it's just sickening to see people so casually embracing this idea.
Yeah, I couldn't. I agree with you completely. As we see here, there's a point that you make in this piece. You know, speaking of the ACA and its accomplishments, but in where it didn't go far enough. And I have a quote here. You know, insurers were allowed to charge smokers up to 50% higher premiums, but it turned out to be a god-awful idea. The penalty didn't incentivize people to quit smoking, but it did lead more people to become uninsured. Smokers are already more likely to be poor and sick. Effectively booting them out of the healthcare system isn't just unspeakably cruel. It severs their relationship with care providers who could support their efforts to quit smoking or mitigate the habit's harms. Such a perfect example of what we're talking about here, and in why this is a foolish idea that's not actually going to do anything. It's not going to accomplish what they want, which is to get more people vaccinated.
Right. And like that preventative care is healthcare. Like helping somebody quit smoking is healthcare. And having these sort of little buckets, a lot of it reminds me of whenever there's like a natural disaster in a red state. And then, like, that's when, like, the cruelty comes out, where of, like, ah, fuck them, like, they voted for this, they, like, it's not the cruelty is the point, it's just, like, the cruelty is a little treat, like, a little extra treat for it. And
it's not the point, but it's a bonus.
Yeah, it's, like, it's really disappointing to see that happen every time, and this is a good example of, like, the, you know, like, the... We're better than that cruelty, aren't we? Like, isn't it about how we're all in this together and we should be helping everybody?
Yeah, like, yeah. If you believe in cosmic comeuppance, can you, like, deliver it some other way than through the healthcare system and undermine everything that we've fought for so long? I don't know. I mean, hope that they step on some gum or something on the street.
Right.
There was that gross Occupy Democrats tweet yesterday that's like, This landlord is requiring all tenants to be vaccinated, and he'll kick you out if you're not vaccinated.
Our
retweet if you support this landlord.
It's
mean-spirited and cruel, and I guess a lot of people go for it because they keep tweeting stuff like that, right? They wouldn't.
But it scares me too. It scares me a little bit. Well, like I'm saying the word scare. I hope that's the right. I don't know. But like, it's like, wait. Do you not see what you're doing? How can you? Go ahead, Cody. You have something.
I mean, no, I agree. It's just like, cause, you know, a large employer, like if like people are congregating this space together, there's an argument that can be made there. Your home. You can't live in a fucking box by yourself and not be vaccinated. It's just, again, it's like this sort of weird, like, the cruelty comes out. And I don't, it's just really upsetting to see. I still maintain that, Jonathan, you made that tweet up. So I will not be looking it up.
Oh, I'll find it if you
want. Do not send it to me. Please do not.
You're sure you don't want it?
I do not want to see it. All right. Oh, here it is. Okay.
We are quickly running out of time, but we did plan to talk a little bit about Theranos and your article that you wrote about that. But Natalie, why don't you walk us through a little bit of what's been going on with Theranos? Because
Theranos was, for one brief and shining moment, back around 2014, 2015, it was a $9 billion company. Basically raised, I think, $400 million on the premise that they had this piece of technology that could run around 200 different diagnostic blood tests using just the prick, just one drop of blood from a finger prick, as opposed to, an actual blood draw from your vein, and that those machines would be available in practically every Walgreens in the country, where people could get any blood test they wanted without a doctor's prescription. That was the idea. She sold it in a TED talk as basically, you know, revolutionizing diagnostics and healthcare and empowering patients and all this stuff. And she raised a ton of money from, you know, this very like politically connected cohort, from politics and media figures mostly. And then it turned out that the technology didn't work. And so it became this, you know, very, very viral story. It's been made into a long form podcast, a documentary, a best-selling book. I think that there are a few more film projects in the works. I think Jennifer Lawrence is going to play Elizabeth Holmes, the founder.
She does good casting, actually.
It is good casting. I think that that's part of the reason why I've avoided it. It's not that I haven't. I read your articles. I've read other things. But in general, I've avoided and haven't watched the documentaries and all this stuff, the celebrity around her and the fascination with her. But I like the point that you have made in that even if it had worked out, that you could do this at home, blood tests and screenings, how we don't need that, and how in fact it's not good. It's not good to have this access in your house, and like what that can do to you. There's a lot of different unexpected consequences of that, and and she ran with this grift and raised all this money on an idea that wasn't there and also would be bad.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think is so funny. People talk about it as if, oh, you know, this was too good to be true and the technology didn't work. And, right. You know, of course the technology didn't work, but that's not even the worst thing about Theranos. Like, it was not a good idea. The idea of, you know, just having ubiquitous, extremely available, consumer-ordered blood testing for 200 different conditions is, I mean, completely ridiculous. And some, you know, physicians were the ones who were pushing back on it. You know, the idea that catching something early enough by like proactive screening without symptoms, you're going to get a lot of false positives. You're going to get a lot of overtreatment. Those aren't necessarily things that, you know, people have to know about or will extend.
You're going
to
exacerbate
lifetime
a lot.
Exacerbate. And exacerbate
Just psychologically who, like lean into that sort of thing. If you can test 200 different things and be like, well, maybe it's all of them, like it's, that's gonna be
it's feeding into people's fear. It's creating a product that, you know, the reality is that the investors were excited because they see the market opportunity of people wanting to spend money and obsessing and being addicted to the process of screening because it's preying on, insecurity.
Right,
because
if there's like a scenario where healthcare isn't tied to profit and all these sort of things, and doctors can do this test when they think it's necessary, that seems reasonable to me. But like this idea, I keep seeing more and more ads for like these like healthcare apps and stuff like that. And it's just like, I just want to see one commercial for one of these, like, oh, you do your therapy yourself, or like you do your, like, you do take it into your own hands. And just I want people to just be able to say, like, here's this app and we invented it because the current situation and system in the country is awful, and it would be nice if this app didn't exist. Like, having these sort of products admit that they exist because the system is broken.
Because our system is broken.
Yeah, I mean, that's the huge problem with, like, healthcare startups. And, you know, the point that I tried to make in the piece is that inherently they are monetizing the failures of our current system.
Yes.
And, like, our system is inefficient because someone's getting rich off of it. I think like a big part of the story that people missed is, luckily Holmes was not able to expand Theranos into every Walgreens in the country. It had gone into, you know, a few dozen stores in Arizona. And one of the reasons that they picked Arizona to start was the high uninsurance rate. So they kind of saw it as a marketing opportunity to people who were uninsured. This idea of, you know, you can monitor your health while you don't have a primary care provider, which, you know, was an inappropriate framework medically and ideologically.
Yeah. Yeah.
The part of your article that really blew my mind was this idea that all of the pre-screenings we do, even some of them that doctors order, are oftentimes doing more harm than good. And I went down a real rabbit hole after I read it to find, you know, that even the American Cancer Society says that there have been, and I don't have the number right here, so 500,000 or 1 million people who got unnecessary prostate cancer treatments because of false positives or because there were cancers that never would have killed them or would have taken 30, 40 years. And that was one of the things about our medical system that I had just accepted as true, was that pre-screenings are universally good and everyone should get them. And of course, many of them are good. They do catch things. But that this
but not
idea,
necessarily.
Well, right. And Elizabeth Holmes was able to kind of use this idea that they were universally good to be like, wouldn't it be great if you could do all of these tests from home every single day, which would generate so many false positives and so many demands for potentially medically unnecessary treatment.
Yeah, isn't there like an episode of Scrubs about this? Like Richard Kind is like a hypochondriac and he gets like all these pre-screenings and then it hurts him
remember.
In the long run.
I just watched all of Scrubs. It was really a slog by the end.
Yeah, it gets pretty rough. Yeah.
That was a Scrub episode, I can confirm.
Okay, thank you.
I think he was a recurring patient. He came out, you know, a couple different times. They were like, oh, it's this guy.
Yeah.
Natalie, it has been delightful having you here. Can you please tell our listeners where they can find you online, where they can check out your work, all the things?
Yeah. So I guess the best way to find me would be on Twitter, at Natalie Shirley, S-U-R-E-L-Y, a stupid pun name that I chose.
I had a moment of like, oh, no, I said her name wrong. No, okay.
My handle should be Natalie Shur, and for whatever reason, it's not, and we all just have to live with that now.
I like it. It's cute.
So yeah, find me there.
Find
and you
there.
Have a new piece that went up yesterday, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess it was yesterday. So the most recent one I wrote was about the crack up of the Time's Up organization.
Oh, yeah.
You know, two of their high profile, Tina Chen, their former CEO, and Roberta Kaplan, a former board member, both resigned over their role in the scandal with, you know, kind of shepherding Cuomo through his sexual harassment scandal and helping edit and give notes on an op-ed that the governor's office was originally thinking about releasing to discredit the first accuser and deny that anything had happened. So they left and then the rest of the board exited. And so it's a piece about, you know, why this super wealthy elite organization and Me Too writ large failed in some ways. And I think it's because they don't have a class analysis.
Oh, I'm going to check that out. We'll have you back on to talk about it at some point, maybe.
Perfect. Yeah, this was fun. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks again. And guys, as you know, per usual, that's it. That's the end of the show. And I have to tell you that we love you very much.